Hello and welcome to Ask a Physical Therapist on Carbondale's KDNK. My name is Dr. Tanis Kitchener. I'm a physical therapist, and today we are inviting Dr. Richard Burt, MD, back on the show to discuss his book, Everyday Miracles, Curing Multiple Sclerosis, Scleroderma, and Autoimmune Diseases by Hematopoietic Stem Cell Transplant. We have recorded a part one, just getting into the different types of MS. So if you've missed part one, please feel free to refer to the podcast on kdnk.org. Welcome back, Dr. Burt.
Thank you.
So my goal would be that the listeners get an idea of how they can identify who might be appropriate for hematopoietic stem cell transplant, who they need to speak with about identifying whether they're appropriate or not, and from that point, where do they find care and what to expect with that type of treatment, or what to consider when they're wrestling inevitably between different treatment options and potentially seeing some downsides, or just getting the feel that the medical community hasn't accepted this yet can be quite scary. So being armed with some information through our discussion, I think, will be helpful.
The goal of this book is to educate the patients, but all those points you brought up are excellent. And the last chapter deals with why this hasn't taken off. And one of the reasons it hasn't is that it's the way medicine is structured. Obviously, everybody wants the best for the patient, but how it's gotten structured has become this own machine. And autoimmune diseases are homeless. For instance, multiple sclerosis is a part of neurology, Crohn's of gastroenterology, scleroderma of rheumatology. And my original training was in transplant in hematology and cancer. I gave all that up. I gave up the field of hematology and cancer because I had this idea and worked in animal models and started treating patients to develop this field. And what I found is that specialists in these other areas, such as neurologists who take care of MS, do not know and do not understand hematopoietic stem cell transplant. That's something they never see, never interact with. And the understanding of the rationale for doing it isn't even there. It's not that the hematopoietic stem cell causes neuro or oligodendrocyte regeneration. No, it's an immune reset, and the body repairs itself. The central nervous system is able to repair itself while it's still in the relapsing remitting phase before it becomes secondary progressive once you have that immune reset. So the neurologists don't understand this therapy, and so they're obviously hesitant to refer to it or to refer the right subset of patients. Their preference would be to wait until they've tried everything and they're late secondary progressive, which nothing works, and then send them. But stem cell transplant is not a neuroregenerative therapy. It's an immune reset therapy. It is an immune therapy, so you have to get it while still an immune-mediated disease. You have to treat earlier, and that's not understood. And the reason for that is it goes back to the history of medicine. You know, it used to be that we could understand different organs because of autopsy, or you could see it. So the skin, that became dermatology. At autopsy, you could see the heart. That was well studied. The circular system was studied. So that became cardiology. The kidneys at autopsy, that became renal. But nobody could see or understand these microscopic cells, these immune cells, until microscopes came about. And then after that, there developed immunology departments that began to study the basic science of these immune cells. But the clinical divisions that treat these different autoimmune diseases were already well established, and all these different autoimmune diseases were given into already many different departments with their own little fiefdoms. There is no National Institute of Autoimmune Disease. There is no NIH funding National Institutes of Autoimmune Disease and autoimmune disease centers where all these autoimmune diseases are located, brought together under one umbrella in which there is a division or department of cellular therapy that would include hematopoietic stem cell transplant as well as other types of cellular therapies that are being developed. Instead, they're all orphaned off into these different departments because that's the way that medicine had developed, and they had already established their fiefdoms. And so that's one of the problems. You could see me at Scripps, but I myself, you know, I could never handle the type of volume of people this could really help. I want other centers to do this, but it has to be done right with optimal regimen and patient selection. That's why I did the medical textbook, and that's why I also have a website, astemcelljourney.com, all one word, astemcelljourney.com, because the key is getting people to know. I've worked on this for 35 years, and I've given talks around the world, and done randomized trials, published in the major medical journals, and yet I'm always amazed at either the complete misunderstanding of what this is and who it applies to, or the fact that people aren't aware of it at all. They're not told about it. One of the other reasons is called financial toxicity. And if you look at these drugs that are available to treat MS, there's now about 15 of them. They're all about $100,000 a year or more every year. Well, that's a crazy amount of money, and most people have insurance to pay for it, although they may have some deductibles and things, but still, your insurance company, society, or if you're on Medicare, what is paying for it? Society's paying for it. If it's an insurance company, it's all the people contributing to the insurance company that are paying for it. These are really expensive drugs. But this transplant's a one-time thing, and you're done, and the procedure itself is $100,000, so it pays for itself in 1 year. But when we have 78% remission by 5 years, you're talking about three-quarters of, if you do 100 people, 75 people for 4 years are saving $100,000 each. Every year, that's $400,000. And now that I'm seeing people out 20 years in remission, this is a tremendous savings for our society. And part of how this financial toxicity comes about is that doctors are not trained in the cost of healthcare.
Well, if you have a neurologist listening to this, how do they pick which patients are appropriate for it, besides just if they're in relapsing, remitting phase still? And where do they find resources to send the patients to? Because like you said, you can't treat them all. So are there other centers developing this? Have you had any success implementing education series where you can share this for others? How do neurologists who actually see the benefit of it get their patients to this kind of treatment?
What I found is younger neurologists are tending to be much more enthusiastic about this than the older neurologists. So I can see the patients. You know, there's a process where we have to make sure it's the right patient. And really what we're looking for is relapsing-remitting MS that's having frequent attacks despite the standard drugs out there. So if they're just on the interferons and Copaxone, which are relatively weak disease-modifying therapies, we want two attacks within the last year. If they're on any of the other drugs, which are stronger drugs, and on one of those drugs they have an attack, and a confirmed attack within the last year, they would be a candidate. Now, generally, we won't take somebody that's newly diagnosed, but if at the time of presentation you have a lot of enhancing or a lot of lesions in your brain or spinal cord, and that sometimes happens, what neurologists will do currently is then they'll put them on these aggressive DMT. I think that type of patient upon presentation would do good with a transplant too. So that's the group. We're not looking for relatively stable MS that's controlled with the current drugs or that is relatively few attacks or few lesions when it starts. But if it starts explosive and they want to go to these aggressive drugs, I think they can go to transplant. Or if they're on these drugs and they're breaking through with attacks but still relapse remitting, then they can refer to transplant. That's the right patient
okay.
to treat.
And then how do they find your resources? Through astemcelljourney.com, or is there another clinical avenue that a neurologist or a hematologist might actually want to reach out through, like the center that you work with?
Any good center, any good university center, even if they're doing standard care for cancer, would have a protocol that they follow, because it's just the proper way. It's kind of a standard of care pathway for the whole team to follow. So the MS trial is listed on clinicaltrials.gov. There is another trial in America, but they use myeloablative regimens, which I don't use because I think they're too aggressive and have more toxicity. That's also listed on clinicaltrials.gov for patients to go to. So if they go to clinicaltrials.gov for government, and type in multiple sclerosis stem cell transplant, you'll see this trial, non-myeloablative, that I'm performing. You'll also see the myeloablative trial. But you can find these trials and centers that do it on clinicaltrials.gov. Most centers around the world outside of America now use my regimen and convert a chronic autoimmune disease into a one-time reversible illness with very long-term remissions.
If a doctor has a patient with scleroderma, what types of things would they look for to see if their patient's appropriate for this hematopoietic stem cell transplant and immune conditioning treatment?
So basically, the criteria I'd look for just offhand for scleroderma, or a skin score, modified Raman skin score greater than 14. That's a standard test to check how tight the skin is, and most rheumatologists do that. And the other is any lung involvement. So those are the two basic criteria. If the skin score is less than 14 but they have lung involvement, they would be a candidate. If the skin score is over 14 with, you know, any internal organ involvement of any type, multiple internal organs are involved in this disease, believe me, then they'd be a candidate for this procedure.
And what about Crohn's
again,
disease?
Procedure, yeah, so Crohn's disease, the patient we took and talked about here, it's really a salvage therapy where they failed multiple drugs and, you know, it's more than luminal disease. So all drug trials in Crohn's took patients with luminal-only disease, whereas for transplant, we take people with fistulizing, stricturing disease that is extends beyond the lumen itself. They've often been heavily pretreated, and we've used it as a salvage for that with in those few patients we've done, you know, outstanding long-term remissions that are confirmed by endoscopy. As a matter of fact, one of the patients in the book that I talked about as being just over 10 years out, you know, she just recontacted me. She'd gone to her local gastroenterologist, and they scoped her again, you know, beyond 12 years and found absolutely no evidence of Crohn's. They did it, even though she's completely asymptomatic, I think in part because they're amazed that this refractory from an age of 12 until 20 disease has absolutely been absent for the last 12 years. And not just clinically, but histologically, there's nothing there. It's very encouraging to see that not only when you're looking at it through the scope don't you see it, but on biopsy it's not there either.
And symptomatically it's resolved.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yes.
So it sounds like for most of the diseases, the criteria is more like a moderate severity. So if they're well managed with low-level drugs, then they're likely not the best candidate because the risk-to-benefit profile doesn't quite balance out. And if they've had it for too long and they're too involved, then they might not get the complete reversal of the symptoms that they've had. Is that fair? As like a whole.
Yeah, it's a little broad, but as a broad brush, it's fairly accurate because it depends on each disease. But you're right. It's the selection of patients you want. In terms of risk-benefit, you don't want to take disease that's relatively benign. But if you wait too long, like in MS, and it becomes neurodegenerative, it's too late for any immune-based therapy, including stem cell transplant. And so, you know, getting the proper patient selection and the proper regimen is very much disease-specific. And it really is developed kind of out of sitting at the bedside of each patient, as well as kind of a gut instinct of where to go next when you're analyzing that data.
So anybody who is listening who wants to dive further into how Dr. Burt's transplant protocols can help folks with multiple sclerosis, scleroderma, autoimmune diseases, including optic neuritis and a few others, please look into his book, Everyday Miracles. He's been so generous with his time here today. I want to thank you so much, Dr. Burt.
Oh, thank you. And maybe someday we can talk about the new thing I'm working on, which are iPS-induced pluripotent stem cells for aging and degenerative disorders. Another chronic, the big new, chronic diseases for which all we do is supportive care and you just get worse. All these problems of aging. And our iPS technology, which we have 7 patents in now, really works. It works in animal models. So I'm really focused to try to bring that forward into clinical trials. That's going to be a whole other story, perhaps someday another book.
Oh my gosh. I want to talk about that right now. Part three?
No. No, if I'm right and it's worked in the animals, what we have is a engineered iPS, or you revert an adult cell back to the state of an embryonic stem cell through genetic reprogramming. That's called an iPS cell, but then we further modify it so that once it's injected, you know, it actually just dies. So then how would it work? Well, we want it to die. We don't want it to grow. We don't want it to cause problems because it can do that. But in the process of dying, it releases all these factors which regenerate a damaged tissue that is in the area or even distant from that area, depending how we inject it. And what we found it does is really through epigenetic reprogramming. And so, you know, aging used to be thought of that as you got older, you got mutations and oxidative damage and things that's reversible. But in fact, there is an aging clock called the Horwath clock. It has to do with a lot with the histones, chromatin structure that can be modified. And in fact, as you get older, our bodies sag. I mean, we just, plastic surgeons go in to try to make you look younger, to tighten up that subcutaneous tissue, but everything's kind of sagging. And the chromatin that's wrapped around the genes also is sagging. And this process can reset that, tighten it up, and it can, you know, we can make animals more intelligent. We can make them younger in terms of their organ function, and in acute trauma or degenerative processes, we can repair that in animals. And so we want to move that forward. I really want to bring that forward. Now, just because we can do it in animals, I have to give a caveat. We have to show that we can do this in people before we say it's going to work in people. But 35 years ago, when I was doing these stem cell transplants in animal models for MS, such as EAE, it worked, and that eventually brought to these clinical trials. So, you know, I'm kind of back where I was 35 years ago, but I'm very excited about how this can fundamentally change a lot of these chronic degenerative and aging processes that are going on.
You're and chronically actually, curious. I love it. Well, that's what leads to these revolutions.
Yes, I'm staying young in my mind.
Yeah. So does this have to do with senescent cells specifically, or is it more global than that?
Oh, it's far more global.
Yeah, okay. And it's through stem cell transplant. Is it hematopoietic stem cells?
No. These are iPS. So what we'll do is take like neonatal foreskin. Those are the youngest cells we can get where there's no ethical question.
Mm.
Any younger, you have to go to a fetus. That raises ethical questions. So we can take fetal foreskin and expand and grow up those fibroblasts to billions and billions and billions. And then we can take a vial from that. You know, we'll just store down the rest so we have a master cell bank of these fibroblasts. And of course, they're all checked for any type of infection and so forth. But to make sure there's nothing there. And then we would genetically reprogram them to the embryonic state. And the cells transition back. You can watch a morphological change in the petri dish back to an embryonic stem cell with all that potential regenerative power of an embryonic stem cell, which we all had at one time in our life, but it's right after fertilization when that occurs. But by the time the blastocyst implants into the placenta, into the uterine wall, those embryonic stem cells are long gone. They've already, well, at the time of implantation, they're just there, and then they disappear. They differentiate into mesoderm, ectoderm, and endoderm, you know, that develops in, like, endoderm into the gut, and ectoderm into brain and skin and so forth. And then they further differentiate, and we've long lost that true pluripotent regenerative capacity of one type of stem cell that can make any organ in your body. It's long gone well before we're ever born. They're never in our body again, but they can be reprogrammed back to that state and then can be used. And the cool thing about the way we've done it, and it's based on our patents, is that we have a universal stem cell independent of HLA that can repair any organ system. It's worked in animals. We want to get it to the level of patients to hopefully that'll be the case as well.
Do you see that working for people who have gone through significant hormonal changes, like postmenopausal women who no longer have as much estrogen for their estrogen receptors in their tendons and whatnot?
Well, you know, where I would start this is in things such as spinal cord trauma or Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or degenerative joint diseases in old people, you know, that, you know, that you're 80 or 90 years old, your hip is terrible, you have chronic pain, and the risk of surgery has a very high mortality to it. You know, the possibility of regenerating and repairing those hips simply by injection of these cells. There's nothing else done, no chemotherapy or anything like that. Trauma. Down the line, we'll be looking at putting grants to the Department of Defense for trauma. Mm. That would be we're actually able to take these cells, lyophilize and turn them into a white powder, put them in a little sealed vial, and when you need them, you just open the vial, add normal saline, or which is really salt water, dissolves the cell. You suck them up and you inject them as needed, and they work. So a medic could actually carry them on their medical kit and just pull them out and inject them right at the scene of trauma to already start the process accelerating. We've shown that we can, increase the time of repair of wounds by 30-50% by just one treatment with this. So, scleroderma patients get these horrible digital ulcers, and, one way would, we could use it to treat those digital ulcers. You could use it to treat non-healing decubiti. Basically, any type of traumatic or aging degenerative process is where you could consider using this. Now, I'm sure there are people that would want to use it for things like, making hair or cosmetic reasons or, resetting hormonal imbalance and stuff. But where we would be focusing initially is on these more serious disorders. And, of course, that also then gives you the opportunity to establish safety in terms of risk-benefit in the more serious conditions where that risk-benefit ratio is more in favor of treatment, before taking it to something that may be not considered as severe.
Yeah. I've seen some studies going on about regenerating ACL tissue using stem cells, but I think those are autologous, so from that patient's own body versus from a fetal stem cell.
That may well be mesenchymal, and people do use mesenchymal cells for that purpose, but there are different types of stem cells. Has been my focus. It was hematopoietic for immune reset for autoimmune diseases, and now these iPS cells for generating and repairing aging and or traumatic injury.
What does IPF stand for again?
Induced pluripotent stem cells.
Okay. Wow, that is some really exciting work.
Yeah.
Is there any other resources that we can find in the future for this, specifically for you? Are you going to continue to document about this particular part of your research on a stem cell journey, or is that specific to the hematopoietic?
My main focus is switching to IPS, but transplant for autoimmune disease was my first child, and I want to make sure it goes through its teenage years in the right direction. But basically, that'll be about 25% of my time. My main focus will be on developing getting these IPS to the bedside.
Okay, very good. Before we completely put the conversation to bed, are there other autoimmune disorders that we didn't bring up that you could see being successfully treated with hematopoietic stem cell transplant and immune conditioning?
So we've had success with lupus, had two papers in JAMA with lupus. The regimen does need to be tweaked a little bit. Whether that'll happen or not, it'll depend. I work closely with Europeans, and if they want to continue on, I would need some younger person to take that. I would be glad to help write the regimen with the Europeans, but it could definitely work. It's just that with lupus at 5 years, we had 50% relapse, and we felt we could do better, but we took very severe lupus, and I think this new regimen we'd want to use would work even better, but I need, more hands involved to do that. We've did it in type 1 diabetes, getting people off of insulin, but the key is you have to do it very early, within 6 weeks of onset of type 1 diabetes, and we limit it to adults, that is over age 18, because once you apply a protocol to children, that's a whole other ethical concern that in terms of risk-benefit, we just didn't want to go in that direction. But we had good results. We have two publications in JAMA on that. That needs to be finessed a little bit more. I have ideas how to do that, but I myself don't personally have the time to do it, but I'm glad to share what we've done and help other people to do it. Originally, when I wrote that protocol, we did it at the University of Sao Paulo, and they're still working in that direction with diabetes. And also have done this in Stiffersen syndrome. Again, we published that in Neurology about 2 years ago. And, it was kind of a mixed result, but if you get the selection right, the result can be very encouraging. So, this can go across the board. There, probably I could name 80 different autoimmune diseases in the book, in a table. I list 76 different autoimmune diseases across pretty much every department, whether it's ophthalmology, endocrinology, dermatology, gastroenterology, neurology, whatever, that of all these different autoimmune diseases. So it could be applied for virtually all or most of them, but you have to tweak the regimen for each one. But, you know, that will require, I think, getting other people engaged in this to do that.
Of course, yeah, a lot of collaboration needed. And like you said, you only have so much time. Do you see any possibility in treating some long-term viral infections with some of these protocols?
Well, not with hematopoietic stem cell transplant. Now, with our IPS therapy, that has crossed my mind, but that's a whole other area.
Yeah.
I need to focus right now on trying to see if we can repair some traumatic and degenerative diseases.
Yeah, pick a path and follow it through.
But no, I think the field of cellular therapy, you know, I think it's on the verge of opening up to having a much bigger impact on patients and improving quality of life in our medical care system. But there's still always a lot of hurdles in getting this done.
Yeah. Any closing remarks that you'd like to share before we close up?
No, I think that last little bit should be an appetizer for people.
Absolutely.
of what I'm working on that I hope to bring to light in the future.
Things to come.
That is beyond just laboratory work.
Yeah. New everyday miracles promised by Dr. Burt in the future. Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you again for having me.
Of course. Have a lovely evening.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Come on in, feel so good, feeling good again. My favorite band was playing an Otis Redding song. When they sang the chorus, everybody sang along. Dan and Margarita were swaying side by side. I heard they were divorcing, but I guess they let it slide. I wished I had some money with which to buy around. I wished to cash my paycheck before I came to town. But I reached into my pocket, found 3 20s and a 10. It feels so good.